The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. I found it fascinating that our lead story in Eyewitness News, the ANC saying that, or the Deputy Public Enterprises Minister, Obed Babela, saying that SAA may very well get a private equity partner at some point in the future, but that the state wants to maintain control. And I wonder just who is going to be prepared to be a joint investor without being able to call the shots. If you're going to be putting your capital into an industry or into a business where state control has proven to be ineffective, would you do that in your personal capacity? I wonder. It reminds me of a quote from Lord Robin Rennick, former ambassador to South Africa. During the transition, he was the ambassador to South Africa, Maggie Thatcher's ambassador to South Africa, during the dying days of the P.W. Botha administration into the administration of F.W. de Klerk and into the Mandela administration. A man with deep roots and connections to South Africa. And he told Peter Bruce, probably 2 or 3 years ago on his podcast, saying that the ANC is addicted to state-controlled everything. Isn't that at the very core of the problem when it comes to trying to free up capital, trying to ensure that state-owned enterprises are sustainable? If you are addicted to control, there is, I think, very little chance that anybody is going to want to throw money at you. Certainly many of the shareholders in the early days of a semi-privatized airports company, South Africa, found themselves trapped. Huge investment happened against their wishes, against their advice in those days, and tried to get out and couldn't get their investments out because the state just made life incredibly difficult for them. Would you put money into an SAA if you could not control outcomes? You can give us a call on 011-883-0702, tweet us at Bruce Business, or you can send us a WhatsApp note to 072-702-1702 and join us this evening on the Wednesday evening edition of The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, no big surprises on interest rates. We will announce and analyze the commentary. I said announce. Analyze. That's the word I was looking for. We will analyze the commentary in more detail in the next half hour because it's important that we understand what is worrying the Reserve Bank. Today's decision to leave rates unchanged for the fifth time since May last year was unanimous. The repo rate, it's been flat. 8.25% for nearly a year now. The problem is that inflation is rising. At the moment, inflation measuring 5.6%, and it won't be at the target range of 4.5%, according to the Reserve Bank, before the end of next year. Also, the world's biggest central banks are expected to start cutting rates at a much slower pace than we might have hoped for 6 months ago, and they're going to start cutting at a later stage. It does mean, then, that South Africa, of course, is going to, you know, be waiting to see what other central banks do. Rand trading a bit weaker than the Reserve Bank had been expecting. That's adding to inflationary pressures. The currency also under pressure from weakening terms of trade. And we've got services costs going up rather than goods. So services costs going up. Medical aid, in this particular case, a big driver of inflation. And it doesn't help that Transnet's not working properly. It doesn't help that there's not enough electricity. But certainly the Reserve Bank still forecasting GDP growth of 1.2% this year, improving to 1.6% by 2026, still below population growth, still seeing per capita South Africans are getting poorer. Each one of us, each and every single year, getting poorer as our economy grows slower than inflation. It's not good enough, but I suppose it's better. Certainly it will get better as we get a more stable electricity and better logistics environment. Things should start improving, but you don't get it when, as I suggested in response to Obed Babela's comments earlier today, when you remain steadfast on keeping control in an environment where trust, frankly, has broken down in many, many cases.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, nearly a decade after abandoning what turned out to be a foolhardy, very expensive global expansion, Old Mutual looks like it's coming right. Shortly after its demutualization at the end of the 1990s, it listed on the London Stock Exchange. It went about the world massively overpaying for tired, efficient old insurance companies, which nobody else seemed to want. It spent billions of dollars doing it. Had a massively expensive River Thames head office, and after 20 years of trial and error, still made three quarters of its money in emerging markets, and most of that still in South Africa. So it came home. Ian Williamson is the chief executive at Old Mutual, and the strategy of coming home, Ian Williamson, does seem to be paying off very, very strongly.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. I think less about the coming home and more about, I think, some of the more specifics of our strategy around focusing on customers, building out our value propositions and building out integrated financial services capability. But, you know, certainly delighted with the results we were able to release today, and the on the back of very good top-line growth and some market share gains in our key customer businesses. So really delighted with the outcome.
Now, people like you, people with an actuarial bent, you love insurance results because they, to most of us, they're a foreign language. And outside of your tribe, very few people understand them. I'm going to summarize it like this and tell me if it's accurate. And bottom line is you've got teams of agents who sell long and short-term insurance products. You've got people who run complex investment portfolios and people sell products linked to those investment portfolios. And they all seem to be doing their jobs quite well at the moment.
That's about right.
Again, there are millions of ways of measuring insurance companies. And, you know, you mentioned you measure future profitability because if I take out an insurance policy with you, you anticipate I'll be paying you premiums for a certain number of years. I may or may not cancel that insurance policy during the meantime, and that forces a recalculation. These things are very expensive and complicated beasts. But if I look at all of the key measurements by which we measure insurance companies, I struggle to find any big holes in these results.
Yeah, I don't think there really were any, to be honest. We, you know, really pleasing was the sales growth on the life side, 17%. Sales growth on the short-term insurance side, 14%. Value of new business, which is the margin on the sales that we've made, was up 37% on the life side, which is fantastic. You know, and then headline earnings up 26%. So we looked after our expenses properly. So, and, you know, the really encouraging thing for me was that result didn't come from one or two businesses shooting the lights out. It came from all of our businesses making a really positive contribution to that result.
No, exactly right. And what worries me just a little bit is where all of this magnificent new business is coming from. We've got an economy that's going nowhere. I mean, at best, the Reserve Bank is forecasting GDP growth for next year at 1.6%, which is below population growth. We've got an inflation problem still. We've got high interest rates. We've got a devaluing currency. So much is going against the macro economy, yet somehow you are selling more products than ever before. Where is that sales drive coming from? I mean, is it a poaching exercise from your competitors? Is there a round tripping of a small group of customers through the insurance market? Or is this genuine brand new business, people who've never invested and bought insurance products before?
So some of it certainly is coming from the fact that, as I alluded to, we gained market share both in our Mass and Foundation cluster, which is the core mass market in South Africa, as well as in our life business in the personal finance middle income segment. So some of that is taking business from competitors, essentially. The market as a whole grew in pockets and went backwards in other pockets. So, for example, in the mass and foundation segment of the market, people will think about it as, I guess, the funeral policy part of the market. That market last year grew by about 4%. We grew by 14%, which is the market share analogy that I'm, you know, gain that I alluded to. And then in the personal finance space, on the risk side, so the life cover side, the market did shrink. We grew, but the market shrank. So, you know, I think consumers are under a lot of pressure out there. Disposable income isn't really there. And they are prioritizing their spend decisions between putting food on the table, buying airtime, and worrying about whether they're going to continue paying the insurance premiums. So we have seen persistency pressure, which is people's continuing ability to pay premiums on policies they already have. That worsened quite a lot in the first half of last year. Started to get better in the second half, was better in the fourth quarter. And we've seen a continuation of the fourth quarter trend in quarter one this year. So things appear to have bottomed in about July last year and started to get steadily a little bit better. But to your point still, around the GDP growth, et cetera, not much
it's
better.
It's not growing. Yeah, no, that's the problem. I mean, the thing is, in a very slow economy, you become dependent on other regions and other parts of the market. The banking sector is certainly increasingly dependent on earnings growth far quicker. I mean, smaller amounts of money, but far quicker growth in other parts of the African continent. We know that your competitors across the valley in Bellville at Sanlam have been doing big acquisitions across the African continent and expanding their reach. Is your growth throughout the African continent continuing to be sort of on the historical lines where Old Mutual has had, you know, centuries of presence in places like Zimbabwe and others, where you go organically, or do you look at acquisition? Do you look at new opportunities in this on this continent?
Yeah, we do look at acquisitions. We closed one in December last year in South Africa with the Two Mountains Group, which is a funeral services business. Across the rest of the African continent, we have been looking for quite a long time. We have struggled to meet eye to eye with potential transaction partners on value. So valuations, in our mind, have been quite unrealistic from sellers, and so we've struggled to find things that make sense. But we continue to look. And if you look at our growth across our Africa regions business, so outside of South Africa, it is higher. Our top line growth there was 28%. It is higher than it is in South Africa. Our profit growth there almost doubled last year, so profit growth was fantastic. And if you to your question around, you know, our established businesses in SADC, so Namibia, Zimbabwe, etc., grew, you know, at more similar rates to South Africa, where we saw the real kicker in our growth was mainly in East Africa.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, just seeing these regions make bigger and bigger contributions. 10 years ago, at Second Discovery Bank, I think about 10 years to start making money. And we've seen the emergence of Challenger Banks, Time, Bank Zero. Talk to me about your bank offering. You've been talking about it for a while, but it does feel as if you're about to get a lot more serious about it.
Yeah, look, the regulatory process and the process of building out all the supporting infrastructure required takes a while. So as you say, it's taken us about 18 months to build the tech platform required to support a bank capability. We finished that build in December at a budget of $1.75 billion, so it doesn't come with a small check attached to it. And it has been audited by external auditors to indicate to the regulator that it is fit for purpose and it does what it says on the tin. Our license application is under consideration. It's complete and it's under consideration by the regulator. Once we get a reply from them, the next phase in this process is we will be granted a conditional license. And the main condition that's traditionally been attached is that you have to conduct a series of integration tests into all the payment clearinghouses of the Payment Association in South Africa. There's 15 of them, and that takes about 3 months. And if you pass through that gate, you then be granted the license or the ability to allow a small group of potential customers to road test your capability and make sure it actually works in real life. So, you know, I can go to a point of sale system, I can make a payment, I can go to ATM, I can withdraw money, and it reflects properly in your financial statements and in your bank statement and all that good stuff. That takes another few months, and then we would be allowed to launch to the public. So we hope and anticipate that all things going according to plan, we'll be able to launch by the end of the year.
I mean, previously Old Mutual, of course, controlled Ned Bank. It became the owners of Ned Bank after the banking crisis of the early part of this century, 2002-03, thereabouts, where Capitec emerged as a front runner and has become the biggest retail bank in the country. Old Mutual controlled Ned Bank, and of course there was Old Mutual Bank with its branches at the time, with lovely fresh coffee every hour of the day, retargeting, you know, older customers. How are you going to differentiate in what is a brutally competitive sector where everybody seems to be doing the same sort of tech, the same sort of platforms, the same sort of transaction capability that is available easily and fairly cheaply for consumers via smartphones, where there is a plethora of choice? How are you going to stand out in what is quite a cluttered market?
Yeah, so Bruce, I'm not going to give away too many competitive secrets in this conversation because our competitors have a year to do something to head us off at the pass. But suffice to say, we doing this with our eyes open. We understand this is a very competitive market, and we also understand how difficult it is to convince a consumer to move their primary banking relationship. Having said that, you know, we have 300,000 customers today who use our money account, which is a transactional bank card that we have in circulation in partnership with Bidvest. We have 2 million customers in our Mass and Foundation Cluster business who have significant brand loyalty to Old Mutual. And we believe that we have built a capability that is compelling and will allow us to offer a differentiated proposition. So the proof will be in the pudding once we get out there and have customers in real life deciding to make switches. The customer testing we've done on the proposition with the public at large has received very positive feedback. So we're quite comfortable with the progress that we're making in that regard.
And then you've got your old colleague, of course, Ralph Mupita, ex of Old Mutual, who went off to run MTN. And, of course, he's signing up millions of people using mobile devices across the continent to, you know, transfer money all over the place. So it's a fiercely competitive environment. It's not only happening in the banking sector, it's happening in the telecommunications sector as well. A 1.75 billion rand investment is quite a big bet that you will be able to take these guys on with the head start that they have.
Agreed. I think we took a conscious choice to go the licensed bank approach rather than a fintech wallet or a alternative solution for a variety of reasons. But, you know, agreed. It absolutely has a lot of risk attached to it. But as I say, it's something we've evaluated, we've measured, and we've taken a considered approach. And we believe that we'll be successful.
Ian Williamson, Group Chief Executive at Old Mutual. Thank you, Ian Williamson. Fascinating discussion with the Chief Executive at Old Mutual, where things are finally going right. Of course, it does help that you're not fighting with your former Chief Executive anymore. Peter Moyo, his efforts to resume his former role, those seem to have been kicked into touch. You're not dealing with loss-making businesses all over the world and trying to restructure, rehone, sell, get rid of things. You can actually focus on the process of serving customers and building a business, which is what Ian Williamson is doing at Old Mutual.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Byron Lotter is a portfolio manager at Vestact. And I think, you know, insurance companies are probably too old school for your tastes, Byron, but they're pretty good results compared to recent history.
Yeah, they were very good. And, you know, despite the pretty tough conditions, I'm sure they'll be proud of themselves. I was quite interested to see that they're launching a bank, considering you know, how hard it's been for Discovery. You know, you can do everything right and have a big client base, but in South Africa, where your middle class is shrinking, to try and tap more clients in quite a competitive environment, it's not going to be easy, but good luck to them.
No, exactly. But I mean, one gets the sense that the insurance industry, and I suggested this to Ian Williamson, and he, you know, says there is some new business, but there's a lot of passing customers around. A new insurance agent gets hold of a customer and has a new pen or something they give you for signing up, and you go, oh, a shiny new thing, and you sign up. And until we get proper economic growth happening in the South African environment and in other African economies where these guys operate, it's hard to see how share prices of these big insurance companies move to anywhere much higher than where they seem to be fairly trapped at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so you look at the good numbers, but then you go and look at the share price and you see that it's been hovering around 11 Rand for the last 4 years or so.
11.93 to be precise here, Byron, and it's been at that level, as you say, for the last year. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, the dividend yield is great. What's it, about 7 or 8%? You know, we follow mostly U.S. stocks these days, so to see a dividend yield of 8% is very unusual in my world. I mean, like I said, tough environments. They're definitely finding niches and gaps in the rest of the continent, where I'm sure there's lots of underinsured markets. So best of luck.
Talk to me a little bit about the interest rate decision today. No surprise there. I suppose the Reserve Bank's biggest problem is going to be the inflation outlook, what people expect in terms of what's going to happen to inflation. And certainly the Reserve Bank's own inflation expectation is hardly rosy. They only get to reach, according to their calculations, the midpoint of 4.5% on the target band by the end of next year.
Yeah, Mr. Kanako is not known for his surprises. So, keeping rates steady. I'm sure there's a lot of consumers out there desperately waiting for them to start dropping, as you mentioned. You know, it's a tough job that he has. In the G7 countries, which are essentially the developed markets, the average inflation is 2.7%. South Africa is a lot higher than that, and there's external factors that are completely out of control, out of the central bank's control, such as the rand, the oil price, Eskom tariffs, things like that that they have to deal with. So I think being conservative is probably the right way to go about it at this stage. But of course, you know, we've got a consumer that's under huge pressure. Don't hold it flat or at these rates for too long, I'd say.
Absolutely. And in anticipation of interest rate cuts, of course, U.S. markets have been behaving like interest rates have been cut by 500 basis points. We've got the Dow Jones Industrial Average this evening, close to 40,000. I mean, this is a market that breaks record after record after record, primarily driven by a handful of shares in an economy that's feeling a little bit scratchy and a little bit tenuous and a little bit stressed and stretched at the moment. But I'm guessing that your focus, I think, for the last decade has been putting client money more in the United States than in many other parts of the world, that you remain optimistic that they can sort of muddle their way through the multiplicity of challenges facing the world at the moment?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, there's always news around, and the negative news always catches more attention. For example, I was reading the other day that U.S. household debt had reached an all-time high. But what the headlines or the article failed to mention is that household assets also have reached an all-time high. In fact, since 2020, household assets in the U.S. have grown by 32% and liabilities have grown by 24%. So the assets have been far outweighing, you know, the growth in credit card debt and things like that. So that economy has been incredibly resilient. And you're right, the market has been led by a few companies, but essentially those companies are making a huge amount of money in, you know, a sector that's still relatively new in AI. So that's still a lot of excitement and potential earnings going forward. I mean, it's crazy to see that NVIDIA has returned what it has over the last 2 years, yet it's trading on about 24 times forward earnings. So it's not even expensive. The earnings, in fact, have been outrunning the share price. So there's a lot to be positive about. There's always risks around the corner, elections, the political tensions around the world. But I'd say that's probably your safest bet to put your hard-earned assets.
Byron Lotter, Portfolio Manager at Vestac this evening.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
And to talk about that interest rate decision today, and it's less about the interest rate decision than what the commentary from the governor tells us. There's an old joke. If you remember it exactly, please tell me. It's something about civil servants in Pretoria, and it goes back to long before 1994, about the biggest problem with lunchtime. I think it was lunchtime traffic. It was lunchtime traffic in Pretoria. It was always very, very serious. And the old joke goes, There was a sort of a massive conflict between all of the civil servants who were leaving the office early with those who were arriving late. It was something along those lines. And certainly today, the Reserve Bank Governor's Monetary Policy Committee statement appeared to be indecently short. It was very brief. I was on a phone call with a very interesting man talking about very interesting things, and I kept saying to him, I need to watch the government. He said, no, but you must listen to my story. And so I was listening to his story, which incidentally was absolutely flippin' fascinating, and we'll tell it in more detail at some point. I just got a sense that the Reserve Bank was looking at this Wednesday announcement of interest rates saying, we knew what the outcome was going to be. We don't need to spend time saying however, how many times. We don't need to beat around the bush. There are some scary inflation factors in the mix over here. But the biggest thing here is interest rates are remaining unchanged. That's all most people want to hear about. But because you are listeners to The Money Show and you are deep thinkers and have wonderful concerns around the future direction of interest rates, the future direction of inflation, because you understand the interplay for the broader economy, we thought that we would get the chief economist at RMB onto the line this evening. Isa Mhlanga is the chief economist at RMB. This unanimous decision, I think in record time, Isa. Again, no surprise there. What is concerning is the inflation outlook. We've seen expectations on the inflation outlook remain in the high 5%. We see the governor today saying at best we get back to the midpoint of the inflation target range by the end of next year. This inflation problem proving to be considerably stickier than most people would have hoped would be the case 6 months ago.
Indeed, Bruce, it is not unique to our own country alone. You have seen U.S. inflation also surprise on the upside for two consecutive months, which is what we have seen as well in our own domestic economy. So that is not surprising at all in terms of the stickiness of inflation. But we also have some risks that are lacking. If you look at El Nino and the impact of food price inflation, that the SARB actually highlighted. But we also look at potential fuel price inflation that might come. We still have risks as far as, energy markets. So that still remain, those two remain big risks. And then if you look at how the expectations, or at least the SARB's own forecast of where interest rates are likely to go, they have changed that somewhat, which should be an important communication to us as the markets and potentially general public. In the January MPC, the SARB models were projecting a 75 basis point cumulative reductions in the repo rate this year. In this MPC, is now projecting 50 basis points, which means there has been a reduction in what they are expecting. So essentially they are saying expect less cuts than what we previously expected because of precisely the point you mentioned earlier on, the stickiness of inflation, which is the same move the Fed made to say expect less rate cuts, but potentially even later than initially expected, which is what they are communicating. But the terminal rate itself has not changed from the previous MPC to this one.
No, and there are worrying signs. I mean, we're going to be talking in a moment to our good friend Wandile Sehlobo about drought. And there's so many warning signals everywhere that, food price inflation is by no means under control. The current drought that we're seeing in grain growing areas adds to that concern. The continued disability or inability, there's the word I'm looking for, the inability of the state to get the basic rails of the economy in terms of power and trains and trucks working properly. It just is such a massive, massive, massive constraint.
Absolutely. And that is a short to a medium term. You could say those are cyclical factors. Beyond that, we have these global themes, the nearshoring, friendshoring, that says most companies are now focusing on more certainty of provision of goods than efficiency. And that means they would rather have a structurally higher prices than at the cost of, having their goods delayed or not arriving at all, which means this is going to push inflation structurally higher across the world.
and that is going to also impact our own inflation trajectory. That's part of what we are seeing. But they, look, if we also take into account what the SARB has been trying to hint to say, we want a lower inflation target, it would imply that structurally we should expect a higher interest rate than what we have seen before, if that's the route that they're going to take. Not in this MPC, though, but this is a message that they have been communicating for quite some time.
And ultimately, that affects growth around the world. If interest rates remain higher for longer, there's less capital, there's less money in people's pockets, less ability to spend. Then companies go, well, if our consumers are not going to be spending, we're not going to invest as much. And you get caught in this very dangerous down cycle, don't you, if you don't sort of see any sort of sign of optimism that rates improve in the short term.
We are caught in that exactly. Global growth expected to be marginally lower this year compared to last year, which means you have to do a lot more work internally in terms of structural reforms than having to rely on external factors such as China's economic growth, which we are not seeing. So the commodity price lift that we got post-pandemic is not coming through. That's why the economic reforms, to make sure that critical sectors of the economy can actually function and deliver economic growth, that comes through. Without those, it means we are pretty much in a much lower growth space than what we had seen before. But also compared to our African economy peers, we are continuing to be laggard. And that will also impact the behavior of corporate South Africa, where they look outwards in terms of potential growth than looking internally if we don't see these structural reforms. So they are quite critical, and they do impact in terms of how South African corporates allocate capital across the African continent.
Thank you, Azim Tlanga, the chief economist at RMB this evening. I've just seen a quote pop up onto one of my timelines, and it is from a research psychologist who died in 2010 called Oren Harari. I wonder if he's any relation to Noah Yuval Harari. But anyway, Oren Harari, a quote from him saying, talking about disruption and talking about improvement and talking about the way in which the world evolves and changes. And he goes, the electric light did not come from the continuous improvement of candles. I find it very funny. I also find it very prescient. And also wonder, what's an electric light?
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. I am Bruce Whitfield. After Eyewitness News, we're going to do Business Unusual with the magnificent Arthur Goldstuck. That's coming up after Eyewitness News. But first, I grew up on a farm in the Free State during a period of protracted drought in the early 1980s. It's as clear as daylight to me. My dad, as a kid, remembered growing up in the massive droughts of the early 1930s. And there was a double whammy there because, of course, that was also the period of the Great Depression. I have huge empathy for farmers. I also understand that when crops fail, not only do people in agriculture suffer, but food prices go up. And that hurts every household, particularly poorer households, because they spend most of their monthly budget on food just to survive. It also pushes up inflation, and ultimately that means higher interest rates. So if you are somebody who loves sunny days, please stop wishing for so many sunny days, because your wishes are being granted at the moment. Wandile Sehlobo is chief economist at the Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa. He's written the fabulous book, A Country of Two Agricultures, and it's looking really, really quite dire for the summer crop growing regions, Wandile, the Free State, the Northwest, and other parts of the country where our primary grain, maize, mealies, is grown.
Absolutely, Bruce. And I think you framed it quite nice, in a sense that at the start of the season, we all thought that this would be an excellent one. We received good rainfalls to an extent that the farmers planted more area this time around compared to the 2022-23 season. So their crop losses only start to accelerate from the start of February all the way to today. And that was also a tough period because it's pollination. You want to receive more rain as the crop is flowering and maturing. And we haven't received any widespread adequate rainfall since the end of January. And I think the numbers that we have now about what we expect commodity harvest to be really reflects that difficulty that many areas are experiencing. For example, I mean, if you think about just the overall total grains in South Africa, everything that we produce, we are down 21% on a year-on-year basis. And for some commodities like white maize, their declines are even much sharper, 25% year-on-year down.
Now, from a food security point of view, we do export a lot of maize. So this shouldn't affect domestic food security, but it certainly affects the profitability of farmers, their ability to employ, their ability to carry on investing, which they have to keep doing in commercial agriculture each and every single year. And that has big knock-on effects throughout the economy. What is the outlook as far as you see it?
I think the challenge, Bruce, here, and I was emphasizing intentionally on a white maize side, because the major losses that we are seeing happening, particularly in the Northwest, the Free State, those are some of the areas that are hardest hit. But of course, even if you drive around in other provinces, in Gauteng, KZN, there are some patches that are there. But my sense is that South Africa is also a very important country when you are thinking about the regional maize supplies. Because ordinarily, we make up about 26% of Southern Africa's maize. And now with us expecting to see our harvest to be down quite substantially, that does mean then that the region will also be affected with this. So our overall maize production this year is at about 13.2 million tons. But I think this is still very tentative, Bruce, because we are assuming here that the weather conditions will improve going forward, but there is no rainfall at all at the moment. And if the end conditions remain this way, these figures may be revised down further, but take them as they are, and then consider also that Zambia has just lost half of their maize crop. Zimbabwe needs about 1.5 million tons of maize for imports. And all of the other small economies around us, they are experiencing difficulties with as far as the drought. This is all to say that there's going to be a major demand for white maize in Southern Africa. And the tough thing about white maize is that it is not widely grown in the world. Outside our region, the only country that produces white maize in large volumes is Mexico. And I think Mexico will not be able to supply all of us on this. On yellow maize, we are much better because yellow maize is widely traded in the world market. And the global maize prices are fairly moderating, so we can be able to source that. It's also why, if you have to look at the Sussex prices today, there's a differential between white and the yellow maize of over 1,000 rand per ton. That reflects then these difficulties and the scarcity of white maize. And unfortunately, white maize is also the staple that many South Africans and many people in the region relies on. So when we think about food price inflation, what we are worried a lot about is that grain component of white maize. While all the other products, I think South Africa will be in reasonably better conditions there. And wheat also is fairly affordable in the world and cheap at the moment, assuming the rand remains at favorable levels to the dollar. Then we wouldn't worry a lot about that, but we would worry about the grain component in the food basket.
Wandile Sehlobo, thank you very, very much indeed. Serious warning there from Wandile Sehlobo, who's got his finger on the pulse of South Africa's agriculture sector, like few other people I know. The author and agricultural economist, he's at the Agricultural Business Chamber. He's also author of a book that you really should read if you want to understand the stresses of agriculture in South Africa and the very deep-seated issues of agriculture in a very calm, logical, and easily understood way. A country of two agricultures.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Arthur Goldstuck will join us in just a moment. You know Arthur is a commentator on each and every single little thing on technology. Not just a commentator, but somebody with a deep understanding and a deep professionalism in the world of technology. But he also has another string to his bow, or an arrow in his quiver, or whichever terminology you would choose to use. And that is the topic of our discussion this evening with Arthur Goldstuck in Business Unusual. And then a wonderful problem, not if you've experienced it, of course, but a wonderful problem for consumer ninja Wendy Nola to get her teeth into tonight. And that is, what goes wrong when digital paints go wrong? SnapScan has had a problem, it would seem. And so Wendy has gone hell for leather after the story. She's chatted to the person with the problem. She's chatted to Standard Bank, which introduced SnapScan to us, of course. And they're wonderful technologies. QR codes, and you flash your phone up, and of course, the payment gets made. I don't know. I haven't drawn cash in ages. I haven't. You sort of think, oh, I'm running out of coins. What am I going to do? You touch your phone everywhere, really. Tap, 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 and the magical payment just happens as if it doesn't hurt you one little bit. So that is what we are talking about on The Money Show this evening. And then at 7:30, our shapeshifter is somebody who's tackling conventions within education. Sean Fuchs has got a long and proud history in two of South Africa's biggest education businesses, and he's gone off on his own. He'll have teachers and he'll have help and he'll have support, of course. But it's his business. And we'll talk to him about how you stand out in a very competitive education environment, private education, in the crosshairs this evening here on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Business unusual.
And I must confess that this is a bit of an awkward topic for me. My producers have thrown me under the bus because they know I have a vested interest. And I will sound like I'm talking my book, and I apologize. But I promise, my producers presented me with this topic for discussion, unprovoked, unrequested, undemanded, unpaid, for putting a topic that allows me to talk about myself on the radio. One of the things I do is I build keynote talks, I build executive education courses from the vast amount of research and study that I've done over the last 20 years on how the world works and we approach the way we do and why we think about the world the way we do, and tell great stories of people who navigate crisis and chaos all the time. And I enjoyed some success at it, but it turns out it's just a huge amount of fun. A huge amount of fun. Somebody who's been having greater success globally in this particular arena is our good friend Goldstuck, the founder and chief executive at Worldwide Works. Now, you must tell me here honestly, Arthur, and there's a very important caveat here as well. Is there anything you do on a daily basis with your clothes on? Let's just get that clear. There's the caveat. That is more fun than public speaking, because public speaking is just super fun.
Now, Bruce, you really have hit the nail on the head. It's about the most fun you can have in your professional life with your clothes on, because it allows you to not just share your expertise, but in a way perform your expertise. It's the only way us nerdy types, and I think you and I would not dispute that description, are able to feel almost like rock stars, because we stand on a stage with an audience entirely focused on what we're saying. We hope so. I very seldom see people sleeping, but maybe they're just pretending. But generally speaking, it's an amazing experience to be able to speak professionally in front of business audiences.
How did you start? Why did you start?
It's a funny thing. It really goes back to writing books. And when you write books and you're seen as a subject matter expert, people suddenly want to hear you talk about that. And right in the beginning, when I first wrote books, I didn't know there was such a thing as a professional speaking circuit. And I began accepting these invitations to speak. And people would ask me afterwards, so how much did they pay you? And I said, what do you mean pay me? And they said, well, they usually pay for that. And I had no idea. So I started contacting other professional speakers and discovered that there was an association of professional speakers in South Africa, the Professional Speakers Association of Southern Africa, which is now almost exactly 21 years old. So it's come of age this year. And when I joined that association, I suddenly found that I was part of this incredibly collegial, cooperative community of people who were sharing expertise, sharing advice, and allowing each other to become better professionals and to earn, I suppose, what the market was willing to pay them
for sharing their expertise with business audiences in particular.
And again, you know, a lot of people do this sort of stuff for fun. They may join debating societies and clubs. They may go off and do Toastmasters. And they may simply go to build their confidence so that they can do a presentation at the office. Or they may go simply so that they can do, I don't know, better oratory at their Bible study group or whatever the case might be. But actually building a business around public speaking is, I think, quite a courageous thing to do, because you've got to ensure that you are at the cutting edge of trends. You've got to ensure that you have original insights and wisdom. You've got to ensure that the people who are in the audience are going to be, you know, giving of their time and grateful that it was you who was taking up that time.
100%, Bruce. And that's the reason why a lot of people start off having written a book and realizing that there are audiences that want to hear them speak about that book. But that's also been flipped on its head now with a lot of people who get into professional speaking because they have an area of expertise, realizing that they need a book to shore up that expertise, to almost provide a credential to those who don't know who they are or what they do. So if you're a speaker, it's always advisable to write a book. But if you write a book, it's highly advisable to become a professional speaker as well.
Absolutely right. And again, you know, all of that hard work that goes into writing a book, I promise you, is not going to compensate you in terms of book sales unless it is Mandy Weiner and Killian Kebble, or it is Dion Mayer and his very successful franchise. Book writing is a soul-destroying process, if you do it properly. And it is also massively invigorating if you get it right. And you've had many titles over the years that have been bang on the money, particularly in the field of artificial intelligence right now, which is the most rapidly evolving sector in the world, which is filled with a bunch of dodgy snake oil salesmen who have not done the work that you do, who have possibly read the book that you wrote, who then capitalize on the research that you've done, kind of pretend to be experts in this field. And unfortunately, you know, I suppose in any sector, they're the ambulance chasing lawyers, there's the gutter press, and there is the plagiaristic speaker.
We see that all the time. And I have a specific advantage in that I also run a small boutique market research organization, Worldwide Works, where we conduct primary research in these areas. Yeah. And particularly in artificial intelligence. So that fed beautifully into that particular book, but also attending events around the world on the topic. And you could almost say drinking from the fire hose of expertise being shared by others. So a key to it is always to be willing to learn from others as well. And yes, you have those who simply take other people's insights and repackage it as their own. But if you keep at the cutting edge and you keep coming up with new insights, what they are borrowing from you is already old by the time you've moved on. So to me personally, it's not an issue, but there are a lot of speakers who resent terribly when anyone else intrudes on their area of expertise. But I must say that the Hitchhiker's Guide to AI has been the biggest boost to my speaking career I've ever had, because it's tapped into this massive interest in AI. Whereas when I think back almost 30 years when I wrote the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Internet, it did create interest. I did get speaking gigs, but it was sporadic, and it was usually speaking for free, and it was speaking to schools or universities where I don't charge. And the result was that I never saw it then as being an entry ticket to a professional market. Whereas now, having been a member of the Professional Speakers Association, I have a deep understanding of what kind of career you can build around speaking and the kind of business you can build around speaking.
What is the value of joining an association like that? I mean, I've never been able to do it simply because the meetings have always happened, at this time of the day. So I've never had the advantage. And nobody wanted to do it at 5 a.m. when I was available. So I kind of have missed out, I'm afraid.
Yes, indeed. In fact, that's a question that people ask most often. And one of the key benefits is, especially for people who want to become professional speakers, there's a range of levels of membership that allow you to work your way up the organization. So people starting their speaking careers or wanting to become professional speakers can become associate members before they become professional members. And their chapter meetings in the main centers in South Africa, Johannesburg, Pretoria, Cape Town in particular, have very active chapters. There's a virtual chapter for those who aren't in those regions and can attend online. And those chapters have the most brilliant speakers speaking once a month at each chapter, talking about different aspects of the business of speaking. And that is almost like having a low-cost education in a very high benefit industry or profession. And I cannot recommend it highly enough that people who want to become speakers attend these chapter meetings in each of these centers, because it really is a ticket to a new career.
And in terms of global opportunity, travel out of South Africa, the huge distances, to make it worth your while, to take time out of the country, to go through the pain of transcontinental travel. How many of those opportunities have opened up to you as a result of your growing profile and your level of expertise?
That's where you could say the rubber truly hits the road, because if you consider, for example, a keynote speech in South Africa would earn you anywhere between, depending on your level, anywhere between 5,000 and 50,000. There's sports stars who charge 100 or 200,000 rand. They don't see themselves as professional speakers, but celebrities being paid for making an appearance. But when you take that internationally, you can immediately translate the rand amount into dollars in many cases, or not a great fraction in terms of dollars. And suddenly you have an incredibly profitable career or lucrative career. And South Africans have made a big impact internationally as well. We have speakers like Steph Du Plessis and Graham Codrington and Paul yes. Dutoy, who are members of the association, who speak internationally regularly and make a big impact. We've got the current Global Speakers Federation president is a South African, and we have a representative on the Global Speakers Federation also from South Africa. So it's an incredibly active community in which South Africa plays a major role.
And thank you for teaching us about it this evening, Arthur Goldsuck, founder and chief executive at Worldwide Works, expert speaker, very talented and gifted communicator. That he is Arthur Goldsuck, and his latest book on AI is truly a seminal work, because he writes in a way that is massively accessible in an industry that we are beginning to learn about. It's an industry that we think we understand, but really we don't. Very sad news this evening. A global figure who shaped our understanding of behavior and the way we behave and the decisions that we make from an economic perspective, a guy called Daniel Kahneman, has died. He won the Nobel Prize for creating the field of behavioral economics. A whole bunch of public speakers have become experts as a result of the groundbreaking work of Daniel Kahneman. And he died on Wednesday, and he will be remembered, I think, as certainly a massive contributor to a world of understanding why it is that we behave the way we do, particularly when it comes to making economic decisions. Daniel Kahneman has died at the age of 90, making an astonishing contribution to our world. On the next Money Show, David Shapiro, the stockbroker and global equity strategist, the chief global equity strategist at Sasfin, will be head teacher in the investment school hot seat. He'll give you valuable tips on how to grow the value of your money. Also, our small business feature will also help you and understand the big business and money stories of the day, all ahead of the Easter long weekend. We'll be working so that you don't have to, here on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Wendy Nola is that consumer ninja, and she gets under the skins and onto the backs of those she believes are not doing good, but or doing well, or doing or behaving properly when it comes to their customers, and maybe when they get themselves stuck in linguistic acrobatics that they can't get out of. Talk to me about SnapScan and what has gone wrong with a massively innovative payment system, Wendy.
Okay, well, I have to just give some context and say that Standard Bank is saying, SnapScan is saying, you know, this is an isolated incident and it's an anomaly and blah, blah, blah. So I don't want people to think this has been like some massive problem. But I think when I've learned over the years that when corporates say it's an isolated incident, it doesn't necessarily mean it only happened to one person. And of course, if it happened to one person, the technology is such that it could happen to more. So let me cut to the chase. It's a 14-year-old scan-to-pay smartphone app now is a SnapScan. It's got a network of about 60,000 merchants, and it does have a reputation for being safe, although Paul Harris's recent experience had him questioning that. So on the 12th of March, he chose SnapScan as his payment option.
I must interrupt you. Forgive me here. Paul Harris, not the founder of First Rand and executive at a competitor bank, and now a gentleman retired, wannabe wine farmer, technology investor, and all sorts of other art collector and other things. Not that Paul Harris, a different Paul Harris.
I think so. I think it's a different one. I'm not entirely sure.
So.
Okay, let me get to his story. He, on the 12th of March, he chose to pay for his tickets to last weekend's Stellenbosch Air Show on SnapScan, 2,120 Rand. And I've seen the screenshot, so it's confirmed there. It just showed up, and then he said, yes. I use SnapScan, I know how it works. Yes, he confirmed it. But instead of that just over 2,000 Rand going towards his air show tickets, the confirmation notification that came through told him, thank you, you've paid 7,190 Rand to Nimble Credit Solutions. So he says, I don't have any debt that they're in charge of, and this is certainly not my debt. And then, of course, as any of us would do, he went about trying to find out what happened, and he said, in an email to me last week, he said it's been a blame game between Payfast and SnapScan ever since. Payfast denies all knowledge of the transaction, and Nimble says that it's not on its network. According to SnapScan, simultaneous QR codes were generated by Payfast and PayAt, very technical, and this resulted in the funds being incorrectly paid from his invest account into Nimble Credit Solutions. So yes, I'm a bit confused by that stage. But the bottom line is, he sent SnapScan all the relevant documentation that they asked of us, his ID, the proof that the amount of 7,000 odd had come off his bank account, and he just wasn't getting his money back. So he's getting a little agitated. But then he said, "Hold on, I did tell SnapScan that I'd send you an email, and shortly afterwards they got back to say that Nimble Credit Solutions had signed off on my refund and that the proof of payment would be forthcoming soon. But by early this week, that hadn't happened." So he said, okay, go ahead. I'm not going to go into that. It's more complicated. But SnapScan said that Payfast and PayAt generate their own QR codes. Payfast said that it was actually SnapScan that generated the QR code. He says, I don't know, I'm not feeling very comfortable about all of this. There's something not secure here. He sent me all the various screen grabs or whatever. So, of course, I took it up with SnapScan via Standard Bank, and the response that I got was that this, as I said, was an anomaly, an isolated incident, and they also called it an unfortunate, extremely low probability situation. The root cause has been identified, but despite the low level of probability with this issue, the SnapScan development team is working on an update that will put additional validation measures in place to remove all probability of it reoccurring, and that will be in place in the next few days. So they've taken this pretty seriously. And so they should. And they're reiterating that SnapScan is safe, secure, and convenient, and we treat such incidents, therefore, with the highest priority. So I said, well, is there anything that users can do, SnapScan users, to, you know, prevent this from happening? And I was told there are additional steps that users can take. Once a client receives a QR code, ensure that the correct business name and payment amount are stated on the app before clicking on the pay button. But of course, that's exactly what Paul did. For large transactions, a 3DS authorization request will be pushed to the client's phone by their bank, indicating the amount of the payment and the name of the business they are paying. It's good practice to check that the merchant's name is what you expect to see and that the payment amount is the correct amount you wish to pay. And I'm happy to report that Paul has now got, well, he hasn't actually, last I checked, the money's not actually in his account, but he's seen proof of payment. So if not today, then tomorrow, that $7,000 will be back in his account. And as I say, I thought it was worth sharing, A, because, you know, if it happened to him, chances are there were others. And also, yes, while they're saying it's isolated and anomaly and all of that, they have the development team now taken big steps to shut down any possibility, however low, that this could happen, and that'll be in the place in the next few days. So I'm very happy that was brought to my attention.
Did he get his? Did he get to go to the air show? I mean, if you don't get the tickets, I suppose you can't go.
No, I think he made a plan to go to the air show. Yes, that was his intention. But yeah, he was then obviously out of pocket for that $7,000 from the 12th of March until around now. That's quite a number of days. For that to happen, and it should have happened, I'm sure everyone will agree, a lot faster than that.
Consumer Ninja Wendy Nola, the most thorough reporter on the consumer beat. She's been doing it for a while. She knows everybody, and everybody knows her. When Wendy is on your tail, quiver, shake, and beware. You've done something wrong, and she will get it out of you and get also justice for consumers. Thank you, Wendy Nola.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Such an interesting discussion this evening with our shapeshifter who has worked in private education for decades. His name is Sean Fuchs. He is the chief executive and the founder of a fledgling educational institution called Centennial Schools. He was a managing director at Redham House for Gauteng and KZN. Before that, ran Crawford Schools and the Centurus Colleges Group. And previous to that, he was himself in education, formal education, as a history teacher. He ran Crawford College in Lone Hill, would have been your headmaster, possibly, at that particular school. What made you go off on your own, Sean? Good evening.
Hello, Bruce. I got to the point, I think, at the end of 2019, where I realized that I became a teacher for a reason, and one of the reasons becoming a teacher was because you want to make a difference in people's lives. And working in a corporate for-profit space, the priority really became delivering a reputable EBITDA. So for me, that was just against my own value system and just never made sense anymore. And I sort of lost the passion to why I'd become a teacher.
And that's kind of tragic, isn't it? I mean, it is that thing where you look at it and you just go, hold on a second, my job has been to educate, my job has been to illuminate, my job has been to bring sort of help young people make sense of the world and prepare them for a world that doesn't make sense. And somehow when that magic dies, it's a little bit like no longer, you know, I don't know, believing in Peter Pan, I suppose. It's that sort of epiphany moment.
Yeah, it is. I I'd come home in 2019 at one point, and my husband had said to me, listen, you've lost the passion. You know, we'd been together at this point now 32 years, so he knows me very well, literally from the start of my career. And that really got to me. I kind of thought about it, and I thought, yeah, if I've lost the passion for what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do and what I've always done, I needed to relook at it. So I'd started writing my memoirs, and my memoirs then eventually was published as a book. And that was telling good stories about the journey I had taken in education and my own journey, just to really try and ignite some of that passion. So I really tried to do something that would, bring back the passion. But I think that corporate space, it really just knocked me quite hard, and I just had enough of it.
Yeah, and so you decide that you're going to, I don't know, double down and launch your own schools business. Now, you've had, I suppose, training from the best of them. Graham Crawford is legendary in South African education. He creates Crawford College, sells that into Advatec, then builds Redham House, sells that into Inspired Schools. And so you've seen the business of education sort of take shape, and you've kind of been part of it, I suppose, first as a teacher, then a head teacher, then as a manager of the school's businesses yourself.
Yeah, I'm a teacher, so I'm going to say to you, David, you've done your homework. Well done.
Oh, and I'm going to say to you, exactly. Is Sean, Bruce is my name. I know that Bruce and David didn't sound the same. That's okay.
I beg your pardon, Bruce. I beg your pardon.
No teacher ever did that to me, just for the record. No teacher ever did that to me. My good friend Stephen Curtis and I get muddled very often. And it is so much fun when people do that, because they come up to you so kindly and generously. And one person came up to me in the shops one day and went, "Stephen," and I went, "Oh, leave me alone." And this poor man's face dropped like a stone. And I realized that I could leave it like that at that moment and throw Stephen Curtis under the bus, that, you know, this man's superhero, Stephen Curtis, had been so rude to him. But I decided not to. And so instead, confessed and came clean on it. But yes, they confuse us all the time. I even got called Jeremy Mags by a hotel concierge at a posh Durban hotel once. Jeremy Mags was less impressed with that than I was. But anyway, sorry, we digress. The business of education and learning the mechanism of how to, you know, it's all well and good starting a school, but if you can't run it sustainably, you're doomed, right?
You're absolutely right. But there's a simple philosophy. If you do it well and you deliver the product well, the business almost takes care of itself. So certainly in education, I think that speaks volumes. The challenge you have in education, though, it's a very emotional product. Why? Because parents have their child. We are wanting the best for our child, so we are looking at schools, what type of schools, and there's a lot of emotion involved in it. So you're not manufacturing nuts and bolts in a factory. These are real live human beings. So it becomes a very emotional decision, and running a school properly, all schools will have their challenges because you're dealing with such complete diverse communities that are at your school. But if you run it properly, the profits will take care of itself. I'm a firm believer of that. But priority to that is that you treat people well, you treat people with dignity and look after your people. Your teachers are critical to the success of your business, certainly in education.
But there's a huge competition for great teachers. I mean, it's so vast, in fact, that Curo has started its own teacher education college, basically to ensure that everybody is, you know, on the same page in terms of education. That you've got not only Curo, but you've got, as I mentioned, Inspired Schools, you've got Advatec, you've got numerous independent schools and smaller education businesses, and Stacey Brewer, of course, working wonders with Spark Schools and others. And it's, I don't know if there are enough great teachers to fill the need that exists.
It's one of the biggest challenges that we have is finding the right teachers. I, fortunately, with 34 years behind me, have networked with an incredible amount of people. So when I founded Centennial Schools, it was vital that I selected the right people and put them into the school, which in itself had changed the pedagogy, how we teach, the thinking, taken tech and driven kind of education with technology. So I also not only had to get good teachers, but I had to get teachers that understood this new change that we were pushing, that they bought into it and they accepted it. And that in itself was a challenge because you as you say, you have a very small pool of amazing teachers out there, and schools that have them are hanging on to them for dear life.
Absolutely. So talk to me then about what you've created. You call yourselves very ambitiously Centennial Schools, but as far as I can tell, there's only one school so far. I mean, it's early days, absolutely.
Correct.
But talk to me about the big picture.
It is only one school. So we founded the school in I founded the school in 2021, opened the doors in 2022. The difference, though, with this, Bruce, is that this school was not backed by corporate funds and sort of massive amounts of money. This was me cashing in my pension. This was me bonding the house with as many bonds as I could get to raise the capital to start the school, as well as getting 2-3 shareholders that really believed in the vision, that invested in the business. And it's certainly paid off. So we start with Campus One at Sunning Hill in Johannesburg, and we are currently looking to open Campus Two in the Western Cape, in Cape Town itself. We have an incredibly aggressive and strong social media presence. So, for example, on TikTok, we have over 122,000 followers, with our videos being viewed over 38 million times, with 2 million likes. So no school that we know of has been able to achieve that. So the top three questions that are asked on that are: what are your fees, do you have boarding, and when are you coming to Cape Town? So certainly our next campus will open in Cape Town, and we will hopefully make an announcement soon on that. But we do plan to open more campuses, not just the Sunning Hill and the Cape Town one. But it's going to be at our time, and it's going to be the right time and in the right place.
Absolutely. Talk to me then about how you differentiate, because many people who go into independent education don't believe that the national CAPS curriculum is suited for the future. There is a real concern around that curriculum. Whether that concern is justified or not in a global context, I cannot judge. You teach that. You follow the CAPS curriculum, yet you're an independent school. You will charge independent school fees. What is the differentiating factor when it comes to delivering an education that operates within the constraints of a regulated environment, yet somehow has to prepare kids for the unknown, which is the future?
So Bruce, to backtrack slightly, in order to change the education that we're going to deliver, we needed to change the pedagogy. In other words, how we teach, our teaching methodology. That's the most critical thing. So schools as they stand at the moment have easily had 2 or 3 generations, even 4 generations of families go through them. And our students today are sitting in the same classroom, same desk, heaven forbid, sometimes maybe the same teacher, good or bad. That's a separate comment. But the education system has not changed. So post-COVID, so much changed around us, except schools went straight back to pre-COVID thinking and how they operated. And we didn't change it. We had incredible opportunities to change it. So what we did is the thinking was completely redesign the school. So if I'm going to change the pedagogy, I need to change the physical space of the school. So the classroom becomes the learning hub. It's a bigger space. It's dynamic. So it's not just desks in a row. The desks are mobile. They can move and shift around very quickly. If you look on our website, you'll look at the under the tab of Learning Hub, you'll see how quickly that classroom changes. So depending on what the teacher wants to teach at that point in time and how the teacher is going to deliver it, it could be in groups of 3, it could be in groups of 4. It encourages collaboration, one of the greatest skills that organizations want today. So changing the pedagogy, yes, we stick with CAPS curriculum. We have to. It's legislated, as you say. We write the IB exams like pretty much every other private school. But over and above changing how we deliver the product, all our students work off laptops. A simple question I ask parents is, when's the last time you took a piece of paper, punched it, put it into a file, leave an arch file with file dividers? And they laugh at me. I said, but schools are teaching like that now. That's how your best schools in this country are still teaching, where everyone else is digitized. So we digitize the learning. Everyone works off laptops. We have a strong partnership with ASUS in terms of really getting quality laptops that will see the students through to university. And work is prepared 8 weeks in advance. Students can access in 2 weeks' time, what am I doing in Mr. Fox's history class, period three, click, the full lessons there, everything, the introduction, the concept, the sources, PowerPoints, absolutely everything is for them there. So what you start doing is your teacher's now becoming the master learner, student is becoming the apprentice learner. Now you're talking quality 21st century education. And by the way, we're heading into the second quarter of the 21st century. So those are critical skills. Over and above all of that, our students do esports, gaming as a subject. It encourages creativity, strategy, communication, thinking skills. We offer entrepreneurship as a subject to our grade eights for an entire year. We partnered with a Canadian organization. They start running, and it's, again, you gamify. So they start with little lemonade stands. They've got to develop CI. They've got to create the brand, look at the product, and they go on to bigger businesses. And then we give them the next lesson is theory. Then they go back to running their business. Our grade sevens and grade sixes, for example, do the Adobe Suite. They are creating, they're designing, content creators, filming. They actually make a film. They're directing it. They're acting in it. They're editing it. They're actually creating musical score. Our grade nines do blockchain and crypto. We get professionals in that train them, the pitfalls, the good, the bad, the ugly. How can they use that and incorporate that into their businesses? So we are giving far more skills than just the curriculum. And statistically, we know that 85% of the jobs our students are going to go into by 2030 right now do not exist. So how are we going to get them ready for that? And I think Centennial Schools is doing that in a really constructive and relevant way.
Okay, so talk to me then about the game plan in terms of this as a business. Chris van der Merwe, the founder of Cura, famously built his first school attached to a church. Another church saw it, said, build us one too. And eventually he was getting himself into a bit of a problem with money. So he went off to PSG, presented to Yanni Mouton and the board at PSG. The story goes, and Chris has affirmed this, that Yanni Mouton pushed his chair back 20 minutes into his presentation and said, yeah, I'm out. I'm leaving. And Chris van der Merwe's heart sunk. And it was Yanni Mouton who went, well, you know, I'm investing my money, my family's money in this business. What PSG does is PSG's business. These are the guys who've got to decide from a PSG perspective, but I'll write you a check. Don't worry about it. I've got another meeting. Cheers. I'm out of here. What is the big picture? What is your goal in terms of creating a business like this from scratch?
Bruce, I think at the outset, I need to say I never started this business with the idea of making money. And that's an important statement. Yes, we will make money. Yes, we will make good money. Our priority is to offer a relevant education to our students to make a difference. And that was goes back to the beginning. Why did I become a teacher? So that's important. And at the same time, when I was canvassing possible investors, the investors needed to have that same value. And they do. They have that same value. So that's critical. Interestingly, the school has seen incredible growth. We started with 35 students in year one. At the start of year three, so having delivered 2 years of education, we're over 250 students. Next year, we'll hit over 350. That growth is incredible. So just from a numbers point, and I suspect when we go to Cape Town, there is a most definite a want and a will for us to open a school in Cape Town. So we are going to have incredible and very aggressive growth. So again, I know how to run a school, I know how to run a business, and the two combined, I think, is a winning recipe and will deliver a really good, sustainable product. The critical part, get the right people on board. So my leadership team within the school, I don't run the school as the principal. I've been a principal. That's not my job. I have an incredible young, dynamic principal in Nkuli Gamede who is running the school. He's understanding. He's learning. I'm mentoring him, guiding him. But he's also working with me, and I'm also learning from him in many aspects. And we're putting a really good leadership team together. So each campus will ultimately have a strong leadership team with a clear understanding of what the goals are. And that, to me, speaks to the sustainability of the business. You know, I don't know where we're going to be in 10 years' time. I think we will have a number of campuses. I believe we'll have a number of campuses. But again, as I said earlier, we're going to open them in the right place and at the right time. And we're not going to just open left, right, and center because we need to produce a massive EBITDA for shareholders.
But at some point, I mean, if you're truly driven and passionate about this, as I fundamentally believe you are going to want to have a positive impact on as many young lives as possible. And assuming you get the demand, and there is plenty of demand for education, you are going to be pressured to do it. You are going to have people phoning you up and saying, hey, Sean, I need a school. Deliver. And you're going to be tempted. So how are you going to achieve growth that hopefully, and I can't see why, wouldn't emerge out of the system and that you've created?
Bruce, when you disrupt an industry, and you know business very well, you have your early adopters, and your early adopters believe wholeheartedly in what you're doing. And that for us has been a challenge in the last 2 years because we have disrupted. We got rid of the school uniform. Why? We inherited it from the British colonial system. There's no need for a school uniform. Have a clear dress code. Now, that is a huge pain point for many parents. No school uniform, no discipline. What absolute rubbish. That doesn't equate at all. So I think as our schools continue to grow and as people get to understand us and understand that we are probably the most relevant school for the 21st century, I think the growth will be a very natural, strong growth. And again, we would have to, as I say, manage where we place those campuses. A campus like ours, which is very strongly driven by technology, sadly is not for everyone. Not everyone can afford it. You have to bring in a really decent laptop. Now, that in itself for a parent is going to cost between 10 and 15,000 Rand. What we've done is we've said, we're not going to ask you for a ridiculous placement fees. Many private schools will ask for placement fees from 10, 15, 20,000 Rand. We don't. We say, give us 6,000 Rand to show us you're serious about your kid coming into our school. There we reserve the place. Use the balance to buy a device for the child. Now, so again, we've tried to balance it to see, let's get this out to as many kids as we can that are on the affordability scale for Centennial Schools. And we certainly are, because we've pitched our fee. If you do more homework, if you see, you'll see our fee is pitched at a very affordable, from a private schooling point of view, in the premier school market. Our fee is really at the entry level, and there was a reason why we did that. We were not going to push those massive fees that parents are paying at the moment after tax for their kids. That was not the priority. And we will deliver a really good profit for the shareholders.
Sean, I wish you luck with it. I'm massively inspired by anybody who wants to revolutionize the critical sector of education. Chief executive and founder of the ambitiously named Centennial Schools. For now, Centennial School. But I have no doubt there will be many Centennial Schools. Sean Vos, thank you.